Everybody, welcome back to our new semi-quasi-solid location. We may be moving around a bit, depending upon, you know, honestly, how the mood strikes us, but we intend to use this location in the foreseeable future, just to have a regular air-conditioned place. Environment was a large contributing factor to getting a more settled location. So here we are, so welcome back. And we are now going to be working on, I don't guess we have the graphic yet, but this is the second message in the series on image. Y'all are giving me a thumbs up like, oh, he's not going to get it right. Okay. But so this is the second week of our series Image, and I'm very happy to be presenting this week, especially given the subject matter. I am very excited to talk about this because this is something, this particular subject today is something we miss a lot on, given our culture and given a lot of the stuff that just gets passed over due to language barriers and lack of knowledge of history. So very excited to get into that. But first, I'm going to recap last week. Last week was presented by Ms. Carrie Bewley. And we discussed how special it is to be created in God's image and how dangerous it can be if we are dissatisfied with our image's status. Everywhere that we make ourselves our own God rather than be contented with being God's image, destruction follows. We'll get more into that today. Everywhere you accept the title of God's image, you redirect attention to the actual God, and life flows from him naturally. By living as God's image, you make people curious, and you make people go out in search of the actual God, and his nature is life. And if you're living in his image, your life should be life. Again, getting ahead of myself, like I said, I really like this subject. So this week, we're going to be discussing a different angle altogether on the subject. I'm saying subject entirely too much, but we're going to be discussing an entirely different angle on the subject of image. And that angle is the images we place before ourselves. Idols. Okay. Gauging crowd reaction. Some of y'all are gearing up because you know I can get weird with stuff. And then you give me a subject like idols, and here I go. Matt's already laughing. He should. You're going to laugh some more, sir. So, I want to start off by just discussing my view on idols. My view on idols over the course of my life has changed drastically. I was raised Southern Baptist, and if you follow certain denominations in America, their takes on specific subjects will change over time as certain things come out, as a greater education is obtained, and you know the just a general consensus of the, what do they call them, conventions, denominations? I don't know. I left that a long time ago. But so my view has been changing, but the first view I held as a, I won't say young child, but about 10 to 12 was idols were any god that was not God. Just like any false god that was idols. I mean, Stargate SG-1, Indiana Jones, the cute little tiki golden guy, and if you grab him, a meatball chases you, or paper mache ball chases you. That was my take. Any god that's not God, that's an idol. And if you're, you know, 7 to 10 and reading the Old Testament, that's all you get is, you know, here are the idols, there are other gods, God doesn't like them, and that's all you get, really, if you're reading it without historical context. Later, my take on idols became that of any hobby that took God's place of importance in your life was an idol. So playing guitar could be an idol, or riding a motorcycle could be an idol, or playing video games could be an idol. Essentially, anything your church didn't like in modern culture that day, I'm going to use that sound effect a lot today. They would just tape onto there the subject of idol and say, you don't need to be doing that. It's like, you're wearing jeans with holes in them, and that's the idol of jeans with holes in them. I want to see that statue, please. I need it for a country music video. But yeah, so the term of idol was actually weaponized against stuff that we don't like and people like us don't like. And that now that I know truly what idols are, especially to God, that is an insane watering down of the subject. That is something of, oh, okay, I won't do that. When in reality, what God is defining as an idol should terrify you, and you should flee from it. And so I object to watering down subjects in order to make messages fit neatly into an American culture. So I'm going to give you an education course. What I have settled on as the definition of an idol is as follows. An idol is an archetype that you aspire to be or to be with. It is an image that you wish to adopt as yourself. Just to give some examples and then further explanation, celebrities, statues representing ideals or even thought processes, superheroes, trends, of course, gods. Anything that you look at and you wish to assign that image to yourself, that's an idol. I've met more than a few people that are absolutely obsessed with Batman. And so they want to be Batman. I'm Batman. And so they want to be rich, but more than anything, they want to be kind of, I'm withdrawn and I don't talk a lot, but I help people. I'm antisocial, but I help people. And you can actually, I mean, people adopting favorite superheroes just because they like the characteristics of those superheroes. I've seen it on Facebook, you know, Hulk versus Captain America or Iron Man versus Spider-Man. Take your personality test. That's not quite idolatry, but that's along those same veins. Anything that you look at and you wish to adopt that as yourself, most particularly today, celebrities. I want to be like that celebrity. I want to have that celebrity's attitude towards other people. What? You don't like me? Pound sand. Oh, you're poor? Yeah, forget you. Oh, you're rich? Yeah, forget you. Oh, you believe this? Yeah, forget you. And they'll agree with celebrities on Facebook that have weaponized their own words against somebody else. And there's no particular side religion or political party that does it. Everyone does. That is assigning that image to yourself. Oh, I'm that conservative. I'm that liberal. I'm antisocial. I'm this. I'm hypersocial. I go on a million vacations. You're taking an image and you're putting it on yourself rather than trying to be yourself as you're meant to be. Getting ahead of myself again. But honestly, who cares about my view on idols and what they are? Let's get God's take. So, the best way you can tell God's take on this subject, there's a commandment about it. In ancient Israel, there was, 633 laws comprising the actual law, but there were 10 that they considered above all else. 10 they considered commandments, and everything else was considered ceremonial. One of these 10 was on idolatry. So let's pull it up. Can I get Exodus 20? I'm going to read this because I didn't feel like copying, pasting a Bible verse in my notes. You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the waters below. Pretty straightforward. Is that the entire verse? Okay. Yes, please. I intended for that to be up there. Thank you. You should not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sin of their parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love to 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. So, verse 5 was particularly what I wanted to focus on. So, what's God's take on idols? God hates them so much that he describes what he will do to stop them. Now, the specific translation that a lot of people keep in their mind is, you shall not set before you any graven image. Now, just in case the context clue isn't, you know, quite out there yet, graven means engraved. So specifically, you should not put an engraved image in front of you. No statues. And if you look at the other commandments around this, the commandments are straightforward. You know, do not murder, do not steal, no false testimony. But this one, God actually camps on it, tells you how much he hates it, says, you know, stuff like punish and 34th generation and those who hate me. He actually camps on it and gives an emphasis to it, as if it doesn't seem as straightforward to us because it seems awfully silly to protest statues. So God is camping on this, trying to make a point. Why does God hate them so much? And in describing, thank you, Aisha. In describing how much he hates them, he says something that I just want to do a little quick tangent on. It is actually contributory to the sermon today, but I actually want to park a tangent on it. He says he'll punish the children for the sins of their parents to the third and fourth generations. This presents a problem to many people, as it should, because this contradicts the book of Deuteronomy, it contradicts the book of Ezekiel, it contradicts the book of Jeremiah. In all three of these books, God specifically says, and he calls it out and parks on it as well, and lets you know, I will not punish children for the sins of their parents. And when it comes up, ancient Hebrews and everybody else says, well, what about Exodus 20, verses 5? You totally said you would do that. What you need to focus on is we're missing a cultural context. He said the third and the fourth generation. Why 3 and 4? Why not just say 4? Why not just say 15? Why not just say, I'm going to wipe out all the mess of y'all until this is fixed? Why does he say 3 and 4? Well, there's other parts of the Bible where you can see this 3 and 4 analogy. There's the book of Amos. It says there are 3 things God hates. Nay, 4 he despises. Why didn't you just give me the 4? Why is 3 involved? What are you getting at? Book of Proverbs, there are 7 things. Nay, 8, or no, there are 6 things. Nay, 7. Why are we saying nay? Are we horses? Why don't you just give me a number? There is an actual ancient Hebrew analogy, and it literally, in its base form, is to the 3s and the 4s. You don't say 3s, you don't say 4s, you say to the 3s and the 4s. It's a cultural analogy saying, as long as it takes. If I have to build a dam across that river 3, even 4 times, I'm going to block it off and get water for my crops. If I have to get thrown off this horse 3, even 4 times before it's broken and it's actually tamed to let me ride it, I'm going to do it. It is a cultural analogy for as long as it takes. So when God says to the third and fourth generation, he's not literally saying, I'm just going to punish you for the sins of your parents. He's committing to, as long as it takes to get idolatry out of here, I'm going to do it. The rest of the commandments, he doesn't park an analogy on them like that. So this is one that he particularly hates. But he's not just out there saying, I'm going to punish the kids for the sins of their parents. What he's saying is idolatry is viral. It's contagious, it continues, and it spreads. And as long as you hold on to it, I'm going to chase it. As long as you hold on to that sin of your parents, I'm going to chase it, as long as it takes. So God is really particularly against this. Why? And I'm sorry, I know I just talked a whole lot to tell you how much God hates it. I mean, he made a commandment about that. We know, but I just want to let you know how much. It stands out particularly severe and harsh. So why? 2 reasons. Reason number 1 has to do with what idols are. They're archetypes. They're images that we put on ourselves rather than making ourselves God's image. Ancient idols were present in temples and households, and they functioned as reflections of deities. They were not the deities themselves. They were reflections of them. They represented them. those that possessed the idols could meditate on the deity's power and presence. Excuse me, throat's getting a little dry. These idols represented qualities such as fertility, military might, overbearing authority, and good harvests. They were things that people wanted for themselves. They didn't represent a particular deity that you wanted to follow because, hey, he's just a swell guy. No, they represented, I want to be like that. I want to follow that. I want that for me and my people. I want that for me and my house. That's why I'm going to go after that idol. That's why I'm going to go after that deity. A lot of ancient kings claimed themselves to be the idols to their gods. They would claim divine right because I have made myself look like my god. I got his beard braids. I have his mullet and helmet. You need to worship me now. And the kings would make statues of themselves that look like statues of them. So you could see the adopting the image here, just making myself all about this thing that I've set up in my life. Now, these idols, they were little manifestations of selfish human ambition. Gods that we invented to become our own god and to shrug off our title as God. So just to put this into perspective, these gods, they're obviously made up. Several of them look ridiculous. I mean, there's a lady with chicken feet and like wings coming out of her neck. There's a guy who sometimes has a giraffe neck and a lion. They were supposed to be scary looking and threatening, and they would devour the enemies in battle and all this other stuff. But they all represented something that we wanted to be. I want to be a strong warrior, so I'm going to follow this military god over here. I'm going to follow Ares. He's the god of strong warriors. I'm going to follow him, and what he does, what he values, what he likes, I'm going to put that on myself. Well, the thing is, we made him up. Why? Because we like strong warriors. We watch action movies. Nobody goes to see the Avengers because they're excellent negotiators and expert psychiatrists who actually can solve the villains' PTSD problems. And all the villains in the MCU have PTSD problems. I'm like, we need to send in the Falcon with his clipboard. Not everybody in a supersuit, just saying. We like the Avengers because they're strong warriors. Nobody ever, you know, cheered for Hulk talk. No, you grab Huddleston by the leg and you beat him on the ground and everybody cheers. Strong warriors. Or I want to be popular with the opposite gender, so I'm going to pray to Asherah. That was her name. Cute lady with chicken feet. God of fertility. And I'm going to put that in my home, and everybody that comes into my home knows, like, hey, I'm pretty suave. I got, you know, 7 Asherah. Got a little golden one in the bathroom on the commode, because people do that. Or I want good harvests, so I'm going to pray to Baal, the cow god. I guess cows chew grass, so they know about growing stuff. And notice that's the particular thing that ancient Israel, if you're reading the Bible, always fell for, was going to Baal. Why? I live in a desert. I want good harvests. I want that for myself, so I'm going to go to that god. And then people who worship the military god come and take it from me. Why? Because that's what they value. They were little manifestations of selfish human ambition. I parked on that for a little bit outside of my notes because I want to contrast it. In contrast to this, in the ancient world, you have all these little gods that represent selfish human ambition. But in contrast to this, you had Israel. What statues did Israel have? None. They had a box that they called an ark. Now, pop quiz. What was on the box? Anybody? What? A hug? There was a hug on the box? Cherubim, thank you. And yet you were doing the right motion. There were cherubim, and they're both doing this number. So what are they doing? What are those cherubim on top of the box doing? They're bowing. Israel didn't have a statue. They didn't have an idol. They didn't have a little made-up rock god. They had a box that they called an ark. And on the ark, there was two of these creatures that kind of looked like the gods of the opposing nations, but they weren't standing prominent. They were bowing. What were they bowing to? Well, I mean on the box. Nothing. They were bowing to nothing. There was not a statue there. And yes, you're right. They are bowing to God, but what's important is that God is not represented by a statue. Just to paint the picture for you, and this is so paramount. This is what made ancient Israel so weird in the ancient world. Every spring, it was the time to go to war. You can actually read about this in the story of David's fall. David got into trouble when he stayed home rather than going to war. Every spring in Mesopotamia, every army would ready up. The winter is over. You can now move troops easily. You're going out to either take land from somebody or defend your land from somebody else. Every spring, everybody's going to war. We look at spring and we think of, you know, flowers and Easter eggs. People had spears in the spring. That was their holiday, sharpening stuff. In the spring in ancient Mesopotamia, you always went to war. And when you went to war, you would go out to battle and you would carry a bunch of big muscle guys would carry with a pole, and I hope they weren't fighting that day because they would be exhausted, giant golden statues of their gods. Like, this is my god. He has the neck of a giraffe and the body of a lion and the beard of Hulk Hogan and the bandana of some dude from Walking Dead. He's scary looking. It's a scary looking solid golden statue. This is my god. This is what he looks like. This is great. And you would carry that and you would let them know this is the god that you're messing with, and he's just going to trounce all over you. And as you're carrying this idol out there, you look across the valley or whatever, and you see Israel with their box, and there's nothing on it. And you say, well, wait a minute. Basically, where's their mascot? Where's the thing that's going to punish me if I dare cross them? Where's their god at? And then it hits you. They don't have a statue because he showed up in person. We don't need a statue. He's there. And you... they have scary-looking creatures, but they're bowing to something, and he's not there. Where's their image? And that's where the question begins. Where is God's image? Everybody else is carrying their image in the ancient world. Where was Israel's? We'll come back to that. Sorry, I always tease for stuff later on. I like to bring it all in at once. Like a Loki season finale. By the way, if I rip on the MCU, it's not because I don't like it. I do like it, but seriously, just help some people out. Reason number one for God hating idols, they're little representations of our own ambitions. There is no cute lady with chicken feet named Asherah out there making everybody more attractive. That is something we made up. Why? Because we wanted to be more attractive. It's all this carnal survival of the fittest type of thing that we've invented to help ourselves. And that's why God hates it, because he doesn't want us to be selfish. So that's reason number one. Reason number two, representing the divine with idols gives us the wrong idea of who God is and who we are. Wrong idea number one, God is not selfish. And God is not here to make you trounce all over your enemies. Simple as that. So how do we know that God hates this? Because it gives us the wrong idea. Well, in a word, tselem. It's like selim, except you start it by cracking open a cold one. Tselem. This is the Hebrew word for idol and image. So in Exodus 20, as you saw on the screen, you shall not set before yourself any image. But where else do we see image? Can I get Genesis 1, 26? Then God said, let us make mankind in our tselem, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the sky and over the livestock and all the wild animals and over the creatures that move along the ground. Image. Tselem. God doesn't want us to make idols and set them before us, be they statues, celebrities, or the simple idea of, I wish to meet this trend, or this fad, or this lifestyle. Because God already made an image of himself. He made us. God did not want anyone making statues of him because they would not properly represent his complexity. Let me get into that. God already made a Tzilem that has authority over the earth as he has authority over creation. Do we always do good with our authority over the earth? No. But when we do, it is good. We have built things, we have made advancements, we have improved things, but only when we were not looking out for ourselves, when we were considering the environment, when we were considering each other. We've done good things, but not always. When you adopt God's image, we've improved the creation around us, but when we got into it for ourselves, for our own money-making purposes, for our own industry, we've destroyed the creation around us. God created a Tzilem that made things new as he makes things new. And getting a little bit into the Bible Project, look him up on YouTube. Humans are very creative. We make cities. We make ice cream. We make air conditioning. We make lights. We make Christmas lights. I'm a big Christmas lights fan. If you haven't been to Paris, Arkansas at Christmas, go. So we create new things as God makes new things. God made a single Tzilem out of multiple parts. It says that he made them male and female. In Genesis 1:26, he didn't say, oh yeah, he made them, and each one was an individual image. No, he said, we shall make them in our image. In the image of God, he made them. That's a redundant statement. Why? Because it wanted you to see them. They were one image. They were one Tzilem. Who? And so it adds a third sentence, male and female. A lot of people want to give the Bible this idea that it is prejudice against females. But from the onset, chapter 1, who is the image of God? Who is the most important? Them. Who's them? Male and female. Not or, not first then the other, and. In the actual Hebrew writing, they are together. It is both mentioned, but both is one. And there is prejudice against females in the Bible, but that has to do with the culture involved. And that is this exact culture God was trying to change. Otherwise, there would be no commandments, and there would not be 633 laws telling you how not to be a jerk when you divorce somebody. And there are laws about that in there. Seriously, when you look into it, it's actually funny when you read it in the Hebrew context. Tells the guy, if you divorce a woman, you send her back with her dowry to her father's house, you know the guy who actually knows how to love her? It wasn't prejudice, it was a safeguard. God's like, they're going to get divorced anyway, they're going to try to abuse each other anyway. Here's this law. Now you can't. And by the way, bring me a pigeon as punishment. I call doves pigeons, I don't recognize the difference. So, getting back into the ark, the reason God had an empty space above the ark for an official symbol was to show that he was not standing still. It hid God's nature such that the only way for the nations surrounding Israel to know what God was like was to observe his people. They were his Tzilem. Them, all of them, multiple parts representing one Tzilem. This represented God because God is one, but he's also several parts. That is to say, God is more complex than we can imagine. He is so complex, he cannot properly be represented to us in a single persona. so he gave us three. So God's image being multiple parts into one is an allusion to his very nature. Don't try to comprehend me. Don't try to represent me with some big, strong statue. Don't try to represent me as a guy in a white robe who's balding for some reason with white hair and a white beard. That's not who I am. If you want to know who I am, you look at each other. You look at the world I've made. You look at what you're like when you listen to me. What you're like when you listen to me, that's me. God made a tzelem of himself to speak no other image than life to everything around it. In the Old Testament, the Levitical laws that made little sense to us, and still don't a lot of the time, they were actually culturally associated with life and or mercy. All the do's and the don'ts were associated with life. The laws were made so that the people would be a tzelem of God for the world to see. So in the Old Testament, God established his image to the world around him with the laws. And culturally, every little idiosyncrasy, every little do and don't that really don't make sense to us today, it was in a cultural association with life. Hey, don't touch that because that's associated with death. Don't eat pork. Why? Because in Mesopotamia, they associated that with death. Pork was sometimes diseased and it was harder to cure than other meats. So it was associated with death. Hey, do this because that's associated with life. Hey, when you have a religious festival, I want you to fill it with booths. I want you to fill it with flags. I want you to fill it with bells. I want you to take all the best animals and make them into a feast. That is in the actual law. If you have a festival, party and be generous with all you have. Why? That's life. It is not death. Death is, okay, I'll send what I can to the get to, I'll send hot dog buns. Yeah. I will not slaughter the fattened calf. I'll send buns. Not against anybody who brought buns, but basically, if you had a religious festival, it was a party. It is life. It is not, well, we got to do this. Okay, we sing a song. Oh, tell me the story of it. No, it was a party. God wanted it to be alive and just bustling. Every Levitical law, even though a lot of them, they don't make sense to us. In their culture, all the don'ts were associated with death and all the do's were associated with life. And they are all intent on loving each other. Hey, that guy owes you money. Forgive it after 7 years. Why? Debt is death. Forgiveness is life. Hey, that person from that people we went to war with and now we have a bunch of them as prisoner, after X amount of years, set them free and give them this much stuff to establish their own house. And if they want to stay with you, they take on their name, your name, and now they're part of your family. Why? Because taking an enemy prisoner and constantly keeping them under your boot, that is me dominating them. I conquered them, my tribe stronger, so I'm going to keep them there. That didn't fly with God. They live among you. They're now part of you. Because making your family bigger by forgiveness is life and not death. That is how God created his tzelem in the ancient world. He made these guardrails, this law, to just kind of funnel them into his image of life. In the New Testament, God himself demonstrated how individuals should act in order to draw that same result, that same tzelem, out of the multitude without the guardrails. He taught us to write, so to speak, by holding our hand and going through the motions. I'm ripping this analogy directly off of C.S. Lewis, just so you know. C.S. Lewis, when asked about what is salvation? How is humanity saved? What did Jesus do? He literally said, he took his hand, put it on ours, and wrote words. And then he took it away and said, now write. And that's all that he would expound upon with the salvation that comes through Christ. Because C.S. Lewis, much like Paul and others, wanted you to unpack it yourself. Jesus established God's Tselem in us by changing our hearts so that we would be the Tselem. So in the Old Testament, God put these guardrails up and funneled us into living a way that would be a Tselem, to represent him. In the New Testament, Jesus showed us how an individual acts so that when you look at the entire congregation, the entire church body, the entire family, you would see God's image. Why? Because every individual has had their heart changed. I don't need the guardrails. I don't need the law. Because I myself, due to my own personal standards, am going to be this image. And when each of us devout to being that image, to speaking life, to being selfless, to loving each other, when we get together, that image comes out shining through. Case in point, I got a boatload of food for hungry kids in the back. And I have seen that same amount come out of much larger bodies. We're not that big as far as a church body goes, but we can still do stuff like that and easily because we're all intent on being this image. We're all interested in it. And when the whole party is over, the Tselem is exactly what God is going to keep. Those he resurrects. So I want to move from here into a time of recognizing. First, I want to summarize point number two. God doesn't want us to have idols because it gives the wrong impression of who we are. It cheats us out of our birthright. Our birthright is to be his image and to make the world around us better. It's to create, it's to speak life into everything around us. But when I see a certain lifestyle and I want to go after that, I'm self-interested. And I stop paying attention to you and your needs. Why? Because I want to do my hair this way. And I want to drive that certain car. And I want to get a streaming PC that glows in the background behind me. And I want to broadcast it to Facebook. Which, I love streamers, watch them all the time. But seriously, you can go after that life and completely lose interest in those around you who need something. So that's reason number two. But I want to move into a time of recognizing. Recognizing that we are not God helps us recognize that we are his image. And this helps us to recognize each other as his image. Everyone is important. There are no unimportant people. You know those after-school specials where they would go through some sort of made-up scenario and they're like, "Oh, little Timmy, everybody is special." And it went in one ear and out the other because you thought, this is just for those kids who can't throw a football. I'm not going to listen to it. Turns out, it's telling the truth. Everybody actually is special. Everybody actually is irreplaceable. Everybody actually is that image. And without them, we are diminished. And I don't mean diminished as, oh, we lost a person, so, you know, we're going to have lower attendance at the party. No, I mean significantly diminished. They are missed. I don't say everybody is special as in, you know, no, it's not a gimmick. You are actually that important. And I know I keep repeating it, but it's because my language fails me and give me the context I need to convince you of this reality. You are that important. God did not make you by accident. There's this little thing in quantum physics called causality. Time can be bent. Time can be broken. We've done the math. We can do it. But causality, you cannot break. And if God created this universe, he is a master of that. And if he's a master of causality, if he's a master of progressive nature of events, this happens and that is a reaction. To create this universe, he would have to be a master of that. And that means no accidents. The clockwork is ticking. You are here because you're part of the mechanic. You are that important. Sorry, I got a bit nerdy. Trust me, I could get nerdier. But I shall spare you. People loving each other is the God-designed easiest way to see the Father. This was the inherent nature of the ancient law. This was the inherent nature of the ancient law. This was the guardrails. People loving each other was the God-designed easiest way to see the Father through every single word of the teachings of Jesus. God Salem, consistent through each era of humanity. We were taught to love each other by the law. And when the law failed, you Bible fans can remember this from the Apostle Paul, when the law failed, God sought to write the law on our hearts. What does that mean? Okay, I said I wasn't going to get any more nerdy on you, but I lied. And I didn't know I was lying at the time, so it's okay. So what does it mean to write the law on your heart? Every one of us is impacted by our experiences. Everything that happens to you goes into your memories, and that goes into your personality. This is why there's such things as PTSD. This is why there's such things as phobia. I get attacked by a dog when I'm little. I'm now afraid of dogs. I have that phobia. That has been written into your personality by an experience. By the same way, this ancient law, this way of bringing out God's image, can be written on you by experiencing Jesus. And there was everything Jesus did went into this. He told parables that did not make immediate sense. He told parables that people still today debate the actual meaning of. Why? Because it's a mind virus. Someone walks up and says, "Hey, Jesus, should we overthrow the Romans?" So this guy had a vineyard, and he goes on from there, does not answer. And it literally said the people went, okay? And just like, ask him a direct political question, he tells you a story about a vineyard, and then leaves. Why? Because there's something in that story your mind needs to unpack. He's now provided you an experience, and that experience is going to change you as you think about it. And it is this change that he's looking for. He gives you an experience. That experience changes you, goes into your personality, and eventually you're somebody who cares about others. I mean, once upon a time, there was no such thing as environmentalists. There's no such thing as social justice warriors. There was no such thing as orphanages. There was no such thing as hospitals. There was no such thing as caring about somebody you've never met concerning an issue that will never be a problem for you. But now it's commonplace. And you look at human history, and that has never been seen before until Jesus. What happened? He told you stories about vineyards, and then he died when he didn't have to, after making a point of, I can get off this cross anytime I want. And still he didn't move. Grabbed our hand, taught us how to act, and let that experience change us. So now the law is written on my heart. Because of what I have seen and what I have heard, I now have a personal standard that I will not breach. Nobody else knows it. Nobody else needs to know it. But I have a personal standard to love others that I will not breach. And if I have a personal standard that's more rigorous than the ancient Hebrew law, I don't need the law. The image is now wrote on our hearts such that we can become that image again, so that we can reiterate what we have experienced. So, I know I've been up here a while, and I've gotten off into the weeds a couple of times. Oh, wow, I've kept you all way over. I'm so sorry. I'm a bad person. Not really. But I'm just going to hit us with a time of reflection. I think there's some slides of this. I shall not claim them. But just going to ask a few questions on reflection. Have you pursued other Tzalem to become your own boss? Have you found images that you thought, hey, that looks good, I want that to be me, and then followed it? Have you respected others as Tzalem of the living God? Or have you seen other people as being beneath you or less important? Just a clue, thinking one person is more important than the other is wholesale ludicrous. I won't get into that. There's several angles of approach I can get into that. Have you respected yourself as a Tzalem of the living God? Or have you beaten yourself up? Have you focused on your past, or have you focused on your potential? Just letting you know, one of these will happen. The other one is already gone. So, I'm going to leave you with a quote from C.S. Lewis. I know I've brought him up today. But C.S. Lewis, in a lecture called The Weight of Glory, discussed the image of God. The weight of glory was his way of describing God's glory in us, displayed for all to see. And C.S. Lewis used this glory to argue that there are no unimportant people, for each of us have been made of that same glory. Lewis said, "It may be possible for each of us to think too much of his own potential glory hereafter, but it is hardly possible for him to think too often or too deeply about that of his neighbor. The load or weight or burden of my neighbor's glory should be laid daily on my back, a load so heavy that only humility can carry it, and the backs of the proud will be broken. It is a serious thing to live in a society of potential gods and goddesses, to remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror and corruption, such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. All day long, we are in some degree helping each other to one or the other of these destinations. It is in the light of these overwhelming possibilities, it is in the awe and circumspection proper to them, that we should conduct all our dealings with one another, all friendships, all loves, all play, and all politics. There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal, and their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. But it is immortals with whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit, immortal horrors or everlasting splendors. This does not mean that we are perpetually solemn. We must play, but our merriment must be of the kind, and it is in fact the merriest kind, which exists between people who have from the onset taken each other seriously. No flippancy, no superiority, and no presumption. And our charity must be equally real and costly with love, with a deep feeling for the sins in spite of which we love the sinner, no mere tolerance or indulgence which parodies love as flippancy parodies merriment. Next to the blessed sacrament itself, meaning Jesus, your neighbor is the holiest object presented to your senses. We were all made in the image. You were not an accident. You cannot be unimportant. And without you, we all regret it. Ah, there it is. Now my language caught up with me. You are important because without you, we will regret it. I promise you, I remember practically everybody whom I wished I talked to but didn't, and then they passed away. Just a passing fancy of, I should go just introduce myself to that person, and I never got the chance. I remember that. Seems silly, but I remember it. So in closing, and after this I'm going to ask the band to come back up, including me. Respecting others and respecting yourself as the Lamb of God in a manner that God commanded in the Old Testament and in the manner that Jesus demonstrated in the New Testament. This takes the focus off of what I can make myself into, off of what image I can transform myself to match, and it puts that focus on what I can make the world around me into by matching the image of the Creator. A perfect little tzelem of what God did in Genesis 1. In everything, be an image, be an idol, be a tzelem of the whole world around you, turning from death to life.